This episode, I'm joined by Jeffrey S. Kupperman, who is a Neoplatonist, independent researcher, and author of Living Theurgy, a course in Iamblichus's philosophy, theology, and theurgy. In this episode, we discuss Neoplatonism, the work of Iamblichus, and the practical side of philosophy, and more. I would like to say a big thank you to all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support Emetics via our Patreon or donation and keep the show going indefinitely, then please find links in the description below, along with the links of how to join Emetics' community. Enjoy. So, Jeffrey S. Kupperman, thanks very much for joining us on Emetics Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to be discussing your book, Living Theurgy, a course in Iamblichus's philosophy, theology, and theurgy, which is a book, even though it is focusing on Iamblichus, it is sort of, surprisingly for its size, and I mean this as a compliment, it's a very encyclopedic philosophical text on Neoplatonic philosophy in general, drawing from Plotinus, Proclus, Ficino, and of course Iamblichus. But before we sort of jump into the specifics of the book, just tell us a little bit about yourself, what it is you do, and how this book came about.
Oh, introductions. I hate introducing myself. So I have a background in academia. I have a PhD in philosophy, a master's degree in religious studies. I do lots of different things. I research, I'm a maker of things. The book came about really because after reading both De Mysterious and Greg Shaw, Dr. Gregory Shaw's book, Theurgy and the Soul, I think it's called, I became really interested in Iamblichus and what he had to say. And the book actually originally started as was going to be in a sort of a grimoire type style. And I got like maybe four pages in and realized I didn't understand it anywhere nearly well enough to pull that off. So I just started doing research and picking up, you know, every book, every article I could find on Iamblichus at the time. And as my knowledge on the subject grew, you know, the scope of the book grew, as is often the case, until it became what it is. So it's sort of this expanding sort of process of, oh, I know more about this, so I can write more about this. Oh, but I don't know enough about that, so let me do some more research. Okay, now I can write more about that. Just sort of growing and growing until it became this sort of, you know, thesis on the subject.
Okay. And I mean, one thing I would add, you mentioned there that it was meant to be a grimoire. I think that form still resonates. I mean, reading through the text, it's split, obviously just to let listeners know, it's split into thematic sections: virtue, on evil, beauty, love, the human soul, on theurgy, etc., much like a grimoire would be. And also, you know, throughout these sections, and sort of usually at the end of these sections, there you have highlighted practices, and it did, you know, that does that, even though you sort of moved away from that form, I would say that it still comes across in that way, in the sense that it came across to me at least as someone could use your text if they so wish to sort of recreate or even sort of develop a Neoplatonic system of practice. So that was that intention still there?
Yes, I mean, I had always intended to write something that wasn't just theory or history. It was going to be theory and history because I'm an academic and I love theory and history, but I'm also a practitioner, so it needed to have something to do. And sort of the progression from meditations through to ritual work through this, you know, full-on invocation of the daemon seemed to make sense as a way to move through the practice while still trying to keep true to how Yeah, Anglicans especially, but Neoplatonists in general sort of divided their study of the work between philosophy, theology, and theurgy.
Okay. I mean, there's a little question I have there, which I'll bring in just after we do the Hermetics question, because I like to get it sort of at the start here. So we have three thinkers, perhaps, that we could bring in later. So the Hermetics question is, you can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
That's a interesting question. Assuming I have a universal translator.
Yeah, everyone just magically speaks English and
Yeah.
can communicate with each other, definitely.
I would think it would be really interesting to hear like Plato and Iamblichus and Ficino talk. Like these three very distinct periods of the Socratic academy ideology. But all sort of in this like concurrent stream, so it's easy to sort of pick apart and say, okay, so these are the Platonists, and these are the Middle Platonists, and these are the Neoplatonists, and then these are the Renaissance Platonists, and they're all different things, but they never saw themselves that way. They saw themselves as part of a continually changing and living tradition, which is, I think, what it should be. It would be weird for a way of thinking, a philosophical system, a theology, whatever, to stay the same for 2,500 years. That would be bizarre. So that we somehow see these sort of separate phases of Platonism as somehow being distinct as opposed to being on a continuum is kind of weird for me. So yeah, I think, hearing those three sort of talk about how things have changed, not just time-wise, but where they're located, the difference between being Syrian versus Greek versus Italian, as well as these time periods and how the Platonic way of life has informed and inspired and invigorated those people would just be fascinating.
So you think that that's probably all sort of agree on the what is there to be done, where is there to go, but really it would be societal, cultural, historical context where they'd go, okay, well this changed for us because this and this happened.
I think there's certainly be some of that. Yeah, I obviously there's going to be disagreement because they're philosophers and that's kind of what we do, is we disagree with each other. But I think there would be a familiarity, a heart of the thought of the way of thinking, of the way of life, that they will all go, yeah, we're doing the same thing.
Okay. That's interesting. I mean, these things definitely will come in, and I mean that actually. One thing that I said that I had a question about, which I was just really intrigued to know because I've discussed this with a few other philosophers who are also practitioners. So I'm sort of wondering, just before we get, delve into those thinkers, delve into the ideas a bit more. You were mentioning, that this book is one of practice, and of course, to an extent, Ficino, Iamblichus, and potentially Plato, obviously that's sort of up in the air and just debated as to whether or not he practiced, but there is this element of practice. Now that's sort of been removed from the professional quote unquote academic scene, and it's probably frowned upon. So a couple of questions, I guess, is, are you a practitioner of anything yourself? Perhaps you're a practitioner of exactly what you've written in the book, and do you find that that's affects your the academic standing, so to say.
I'm a practitioner in a couple of different systems, including the Neoplatonic stuff that I wrote. I'm sort of outside of academia these days, but when I was, it wasn't really something that came up. I wasn't exactly announcing, oh, by the way, I practice ceremonial magic. Especially, when I spent several years working at a Catholic university, didn't really seem appropriate at the time. So it's never really been an issue. And I can generally sort of spin it as being part of my academic interest. Like, well, I study, I did my doctoral thesis on Wiccan seasonal celebrations. I'm not Wiccan myself, but somebody's like, hey, I saw you doing this thing. It's like, well, yeah, it's part of my area of study. If I'm going to know about it, I have to engage in it in some way. And part of my work has been field work. So there's a element of cultural anthropology going on. So I have to delve into it to a certain extent. How far that extent goes is really none of their business.
I mean, do you think that the study of the, especially Neoplatonism in general and Platonism, do you think the study of, and we'll get to whether or not, in what way they differ, do you think the study of those things has almost been, it's almost like you're missing a cornerstone if you don't, because sometimes even if you don't engage in the practice, and I mean physically engage in it as in practicing the ceremonies, doing whatever the rituals are, even if you don't say like take that side seriously, which some academics might not. They might say, oh, that's allegorical, or it's, that there's some element of myth there. Do you feel that the study is often a bit hampered because people don't engage in that side, even if it is just an active theoretical engagement, but go, okay, let's take this side seriously?
Absolutely. And it's really only been in the last, I'd say, decade or so, which is, in academic terms, no time whatsoever. It's baby. It still is in infancy. It's really only been quite recently where we've seen a few scholars, off the top of my head, Dr. Gregory Shaw, Dr. Angela Voss, take the ritual side, the religious side of later Platonism seriously. And it shows in their work how much more deeply they can sort of get into the minds of the people they're studying. Until very recently, sort of the works of E.R. Dodds, who sort of castigated Theurgy and Iamblichus, he called De Mysterious, I'm trying to remember his exact phrase, but something like a manifesto of the irrational. And that stuck for like 60 years. And so people just sort of, well, we're just not going to study that part. It really shows in Proclus's studies. We know Proclus was a practitioner of Theurgy. And you rarely see it being a major part of studies on Proclus. And in fact, to the extent that the theurgic elements of later Platonism tend to get ignored, when you see books on the later Platonists, you get Plotinus, Porphyry, skip 200 years, Proclus, and they're on. They just ignore Iamblichus, which is fascinating because if you're familiar at all with Proclus, he's so heavily influenced by Iamblichus's writing. To the point where I often joke that Proclus is really just cribbing on Iamblichus's work in several instances. So I think you miss just a huge amount of the field simply not by not taking it seriously. And by taking it seriously, meaning you don't, at the minimum, not taking that the people who practiced it took it seriously. It tends to just get written off completely and ignored, which I think has been a great detriment to the field. And as we're sort of seeing this, it's not exactly new. They're not exactly new scholars, obviously, but seeing now scholars beginning to take theurgy and religious Platonism seriously, even if they don't engage in it, they don't believe in it themselves, understanding that the people who practiced it did take it seriously, that they're not being irrational, that it significantly informs their philosophy, and their philosophy is still legitimate philosophy, not theology disguised as philosophy, if that makes sense.
I mean, it's interesting that you bring up that Iamblichus is the one that's missed, because he's obviously the one of our most important sort of sources on Pythagoras himself, and in the mystical Pythagoras comes from Iamblichus, so that also is sort of, you draw a line under that and get rid of that as well. But it brings me to the big first question, really, which is one we've sort of been discussing abstractly here. I mean, firstly, it's the definition of theurgy, but that sort of, because that's such a, that's not a word that's, you know, it's not used in philosophy outside of these contexts very often, correct me if I'm wrong there, but also this, it's a question and a point that you bring up in the book a lot, and I think it's really important in relation to what we've just been speaking about, which is that you can bring in all these concepts such as beauty and virtue and love, etc., God, politics. You can bring them up now in the current day in relation to these things, but it's often sort of changed because our conception of what these things mean is so, so far removed from the Platonic or Neoplatonic understanding that we almost begin from, you know, just the completely wrong foundation. And do you think this is often why some people become a bit almost unstuck with Neoplatonism? Is because, you know, they're dealing with concepts which aren't the concepts that the Neoplatonists are dealing with, even though they're taking the same signifier, so to say.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I think when it comes to you know, later Platonism, Neoplatonism, whatever you want to call it, I think the thing that sort of unsticks people is the religious element of it. That, you know, to the modern mind, Platonism is this purely intellectual philosophical school, which is absolute rubbish, of course. I mean, if you study the history of Plato himself and really read the dialogues, you know, Plato is obviously a deeply religious person, and his religiosity, I think, clearly influences his philosophy and his way of life. But we don't like looking at Plato and Socrates in those manners. We like to look at them from this very sort of abstract, almost clinical academic view. As soon as we start saying, oh, by the way, people lived this, you know, this wasn't just an intellectual endeavor. You know, Plato's academy produced politicians, you know, people who lived a Platonic life, fulfilling, you know, public service. That was one of the big things that Plato seemed to do. And he writes about politics all the time, but he never writes about it in this abstract way. Politics, to borrow from Aristotle, you know, a politician was supposed to be somebody who understood the human soul, and so was able to guide humans to their greatest good. I think all of that tends to get lost. It's kind of uncomfortable in academia, I think, to recognize philosophical systems as something more than just intellectual systems. You know, when I was in college, 1,000 years ago, and I was in philosophy club, and basically someone would come up and present their idea, and then like the rest of the hour was everybody else kicking over their intellectual sandcastle, and that was what philosophy was for a lot of people. But I think we go back, you know, not even a long time, you know, a couple hundred years, and philosophy is a very different thing. Philosophy is this living tradition of how am I going to live my life to the best, not just how do I think deep thoughts. So even that, I think, can be a sticking point. I mean, it certainly changes, you know, when you're doing, you know, master's and doctoral level work to a certain degree. But when you're just sort of teaching philosophy, all that sort of kind of gets left out. And then to recognize that these people, you know, practiced religions and maybe practiced some sort of, you know, esoteric thing as well, that just sort of becomes, you know, one step too far, I think.
Okay. So it's less a case of sort of different definitions, and more a case of, once again, sort of excluding the stuff that we just almost aren't too comfortable with anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't fit nicely into academic boxes, and you know, we love our boxes, and so if I can't fit it neatly, I'm going to put it over to the side until somebody figures out how to categorize it. I mean, this doesn't, you know, clearly describe all academics on the subject, you know, clearly, because we've talked about Dr. Shaw, Dr. Voss, people like them, where they clearly have found a way to make sense of these elements, you know, the religious and the theurgical elements. But there's still a whole lot of theurgy is simply irrational going out there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what, it's a word that not everyone's going to be familiar with. So what is the definition of theurgy? What is theurgy?
So from like a literal translation perspective, the word means something along the lines of divine activity, God working. It comes from, you know, the Greek word for God, and the Greek word for energy, activity, doing stuff, basically. In a more practical sense, it's kind of a broad term. It's not just like this kind of spiritualized ceremonial magic, though there is that to it. You know, you read Proclus especially, and he writes about prayer, and prayer clearly has a theurgic element to it, and not just like special prayers with you know, the barbaric names of invocation that you see in like the Greek magical papyri, but like any prayer, like you go to a temple and you pray with everybody else, if you approach it correctly, it has a theurgical property to it that uplifts the soul towards the gods. And I think that's really what, when we're talking about theurgy, we're talking about practices that elevate the soul. They're anagogic, to throw out technical terminology, because I'm an academic, so I have to do that. There's this anagogic principle that raises the soul upward. But that's not necessarily the end of it. That's certainly part of it. We tend to look at theurgy as a very mystical process. But we know, you know, Proclus used theurgy to end droughts, which is not what we would normally think of as a mystical sort of thing. But through theurgy, you are able to sort of interact better, more closely as, you know, the governing powers of creation, whether those are daemons or heroes or angels, archangels, gods, etc. You sort of become closer to those beings, more like those beings, more like the purified soul that's sort of at the core of all of us. And through that are able to affect the world in a way that's in alignment with the divine intention, as opposed to personal intention, which is sort of how Iamblichus sort of distinguishes between theurgic practice and sorcery.
Okay. Is theurgy specific to Platonism or Neoplatonism, or has it been, is this a sort of an all-encompassing practice?
I think the language, certainly, you know, the specific terminology of theurgy, I think, tends to stay in, you know, Platonism. Not, you hear it in some forms of modern Gnosticism, but I don't think, you know, the ideology is particular to these. I mean, if you look at you know, like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and the concept of the great work, the becoming, you know, more human than human. I think sort of the ultimate goals that we see in a lot of ceremonial magic are theurgic in nature as well.
Okay, that makes sense. So do you? I mean, perhaps this is probably, I imagine, one of the bugbears of any Plato or Neoplatonist sort of scholar is, is there a difference between Platonism and Neoplatonism? Is the difference simply a contemporary thing due to, you know, that what we previously spoke about, that sort of, because there's been a historical lineage and there's hundreds of years between, we sort of have to differentiate, whereas in their own times, none of these people, Ficino, Iamblichus, Plotinus, would have differentiated between what it was they were doing.
Right. I would say, trying to phrase it the right way. There's clearly a difference between, you know, what Plato's doing and what Iamblichus is doing, what Ficino is doing. But those differences are, I think, due to time, not due to a core difference in their Platonism. I think their Platonism is still Platonism, if that makes sense. So changes, like we were talking about, the changes are the evolution of the way of thoughts over time and distance and place. And we see it going in a bunch of different directions. You've got like Pseudo-Dionysius and sort of where he's going, and then, St. Augustine goes where he sort of takes some of that and goes where he's going, and Ficino takes some of that and goes where he's going. And I think all of them are legitimately forms of Platonism.
Okay. And I mean, the one thing, I guess, you know, there's plenty of elements to Platonism, Neoplatonism that we could emphasize as things that carry through, but many of which will appear in any other philosophy. So the concept of the soul, or the idea of virtue, or what to do with evil, will appear in practically any sort of, let's say, system of philosophy. But the one thing I put in just to emphasize for those who aren't familiar with Neoplatonism is the one. I want to say the concept of the one, but that's not strictly correct if we're treating the practice with respect. So I would just, the good or the one. This, I guess, needs to be emphasized as, the thing of absolute importance, right?
I think so. And again, the idea changes. I don't know that when Socrates or Plato Socrates is talking about, the image of the good, is exactly what Plato is talking about, is exactly what Plotinus or Porphyry or Iamblichus is talking about. I think the idea certainly evolves over time and becomes much more almost reified. It becomes much more of a concept of a divine being. And being's totally the wrong word for the one, because the one is beyond being, which is why it's so hard to talk about. But I the concept is I think certainly carries out from Socrates through Ficino into especially modern religious Neoplatonism. I think it's of absolute importance, because without the one, there is nothing else. So if we leave out the one, we sort of leave out not the first link in the chain of being, but the thing from which all the chains ultimately are suspended from.
And it's interesting you said that modern forms of Neoplatonism are more religious. So in my understanding of the one, and perhaps you can, I'm completely wrong in this, Neoplatonism does seem to transcend what we could sort of understand as socio-cultural religion and sects and denominations, for instance, in that understanding of just this, well, what we've said, the one. So is that one of the key changes throughout time, that as we get closer to the present day, it does become more of a traditionally religious thing?
That's a really good question. For me personally, just to some degree, yeah. But I think, the beauty of Platonism in general, and certainly people will disagree with me on this, but that it is a kind of hermeneutical lens through which we view the world, which means we can view lots of different religiosities through the Platonic lens, which we've absolutely seen happen. Pseudo-Dionysius, St. Augustine, certainly. A lot of the Sufis were heavily influenced by the later Platonists as well. Plethon, who got the original Greek of Plato to the Medici family, Fraccino, to translate, he definitely originally saw his Eastern Orthodox Christianity through a Platonic lens, and then sort of became a Platonic neo-pagan, where he just sort of created afresh a Platonic Platonism based on his Neoplatonic background. So while I think you can have, and I've sort of worked vaguely in this direction, a Neoplatonic religion that views itself as Neoplatonic first, I don't think that's either necessary or even probably common. I think we tend to Platonize our religiosity. I see it in modern paganism, especially where we see concepts of the one behind the goddess and the god, for instance, or archetypal worlds from which everything else depends, based on Plato's notion of the ideas of the forms. So I think it can go in a lot of different ways, and I think it has gone in a lot of different ways. But I think what we tend to mostly see today is the religion seen through that Platonic lens, as opposed to a sort of pure, whatever that might mean, Neoplatonic religion. I have no idea if I just answered your question or not.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. Do you think maybe that might be why that, you know, thinking of the Ennead especially here, Plotinus sort of emphasizes that it's sort of pointless to have a philosophy that isn't practiced or doesn't have some practice attached to it, even in the sense of abstractly applying that philosophy to everyday life in the sense that you practice it in that manner. Do you think that some modern Neoplatonism might have moved away from that notion, which seems key to Neoplatonism, but you know, the notion that there is really, you know, philosophy is to be practiced?
To some extent, I mean, I think that's happened a lot in modern philosophy in general. I see it with like Stoicism a lot, where Stoicism was clearly a lived practice. The entire point was to be able to live a certain kind of, you know, balanced life that sort of didn't go to extremes, understood what you could control and what you could not control, and that you would live your life accordingly. And then we read Marcus Aurelius and we sort of academically pick over Aurelius or Epictetus or Zeno and go, okay, well, that's all very interesting. Now let's move on to this other philosopher where we do the same thing. But we tend to skip over that. Also, this has a real practical application. Neoplatonism may be sort of an egregious account of that, where, you know, there was so much going on in Platonic practice, especially once we get into the later Platonisms, that we just sort of, well, that's an interesting idea. But to be fair, one could ask, you know, how do you teach that? You know, the people that we're talking about, you know, had academies of their own where people came and lived and practiced. And we don't teach philosophy like that anymore. I'm not sure that we could teach philosophy like that, at least on any sort of large scale. So to be fair, while I think we've lost a significant element of philosophical practice, and especially Neoplatonic practice, I'm not sure how we would retain it in an academic setting, at least.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually. It's made me sort of realize that I guess this is very specific to the West, but we draw the lines between certain types of intellectuals and practitioners very, very clearly. You know, you're either primarily a guru or a sage, or you're primarily an academic and a teacher. You can't toe that line. So you can't really say to your parents, you know, we say to our parents, "Oh, I'm off to university to study philosophy." It would be a bit different to say, "I'm off to practice philosophy," in the sense of, you know, putting on some ritual wear and practicing philosophy in that sense. But perhaps that would be a far healthier way to do it, or phrase it in that sense, that philosophy is to be practiced. Otherwise, I don't really see any point in it at all.
Yeah, no, go on, sorry.
Oh no, go on.
Yeah, it just occurred to me, when we talk about theology academically, we talk about I'm going to go do theology as opposed to I'm going to go study philosophy. And it would be really interesting to bring that language, I'm going to go do philosophy. It's not just this thing that I study, but it's a thing that's part of my life. And it'd be sort of interesting if we could bring that into the philosophical world, out of the theological world, which I know has, academic sort of, theology is sort of in its own little world in academia because it's so heavily attached to religious practice. You don't just study theology for the heck of it. Usually you're studying theology to do it, to become, a religious practitioner, priest, priestess, minister, rabbi, whatever. That's why you're studying it. You're not just doing it for an intellectual advancement. And that sort of, creeps out, the related traditions of religious studies and philosophy. To varying extents. Though, to be fair, very modern religious studies, and again, the last 20 years, maybe 30 years or so, has started, moving away from the classical Lancastrian model of textual analysis to include, history and especially anthropology. Which has changed how we do religious studies to a certain extent. And I think absolutely for the betterment of the study, it would be sort of fascinating to do that in philosophy. But I'm not sure I get how you would do that because we don't have, schools of, Platonic academies and, whatever the Epicureans were doing, whatever the Stoics were doing. We don't really have that existing in the West anymore. We see it to some extent in China, where they've recently started bringing back Confucian schools, for instance, or in the practice of Taoism, whether it's philosophical or religious or esoteric, or Buddhism, which the West loves to look at as a philosophy and completely ignores the sort of deeply quote irrational unquote religious elements, the ritual, the mythology, the various gods and spirits that are all over the place, even in our, even in like Zen, which we tend to view in the West as being this almost entirely philosophical system, and it's so very much not. If you would study these systems as they are living, you sort of get this more deeper understanding of it. But it's hard to find living examples of Neoplatonism or Stoicism or Epicureanism on a large scale. And what we have, probably the closest for that, is modern Gnosticism, which again is moves more towards the religious side, though by no means completely so. There are a lot of excellent academic philosophers involved in the modern Gnostic movement, as well as excellent theologians. But it's still not the same as a living Platonic tradition, ignoring the fact that Gnosticism is sort of classified as Middle Platonism. We tend to see it more, and what has survived of it in writings tends to be very much more religious than clearly philosophical, as you know, the works of Plotinus, Porphyry, Iamblichus, Proclus, Simplicius, and so on are. So we just don't have that sort of thing to delve into in the West, I think, which makes it very difficult.
I mean, it's interesting, you know, what you said there. We don't treat them like a living philosophy. You know, the idea of going to do something implies that it's still alive, still around, whereas, you know, history is the thing you should study, because ultimately, maybe many historians might disagree with me on this, but eventually there's going to be a point where you've gathered everything you can from that era, because it is dead, it's gone, and then you just keep, that is there to study. Whereas to imply, oh, I'm studying Neoplatonism, is to say, well, hang on, it's still continuing, it's still there. If anything that it theorizes or talks about is true, then of course it's still there. So I guess, yeah, you know, maybe we should start a movement to bring back that language that we're going to do philosophy. But it brings in a sort of a big question, because obviously it's a long history of Neoplatonism. And it's the Western question I ask a lot of guests, actually, about the topic or the theme, and I guess it's probably a Western error on my part. But what's the goal? What's the teleology of Neoplatonism? What is the purpose of this practice?
Actually, I think that is probably the easiest question that you have asked, because Plato directly answers it, which is to become like God so far as possible. Now, of course, that needs a huge amount of unpacking. From the later Platonic view, at least my view of it, you know, the human soul is a particular kind of thing. And from at least Iamblichus on, it is a thing that has fallen into materiality. Porphyry and Plotinus say that ultimately the soul, you know, remains in the spirit, whatever you want to call the spiritual realm, you know, contemplating the gods or the one or whatever. But from Iamblichus onward, we see that the soul has descended into materiality and has essentially lost memory of what it is. And so the goal of Platonic practice is to remember our true nature, which is not just that we are souls, but that our souls exist for a certain purpose. Iamblichus sort of really starts on the idea. I mean, he's borrowing from Plato, and Proclus moves on it. But from their ideology, each soul, as it is, you know, brought out of this great mixing cup of divine stuff, is sown into sown like you sow seeds, not like needle and thread, sown into the orbit of one of the visible gods, you know, the planetary deities, and that basically becomes the nature of that soul. And so remembering what we are is not just remembering that we are this bodiless being, but we're a certain kind of bodiless being that exist to do certain sorts of things. And so what we sort of see in Iamblichus and I think Proclus is that part of the work is not simply remembering who we are, but after doing so, engaging in demiurgic work, the work of the demiurge, which is another idea that has to be unpacked, because the term is used a lot in modern Gnosticism. and it means something completely different in Gnosticism than it does in Platonism. In Platonism, the demiurge, which a word that basically means craftsman, is this divine being that takes, looks up into the world of the forms and translates it ultimately into a physical world. And the demiurge does this, according to Plato, because the demiurge itself is good and wants only good things for everything else that exists. But the work of the demiurge is not, I think, to be understood as a sort of one and done deal. It is a continual unfolding of creation, moving creation so it becomes more and more a perfect one of what it is. And part of the work of the purified soul is to engage in that as well. So it's not just about me, as some spiritual traditions at least make it look like. It's not just I take care of my soul, and when my soul's good, I'm good to go. Gregory Shaw actually, and the words just escaped me, compares Iamblichus's theurgic notions to the work of the bodhisattvas in Buddhism, where the bodhisattva moves to within a step of achieving nirvana, but then holds back to help everybody else attain to nirvana. And when you read Iamblichus, especially in what remains of his sort of political writings, the work of, if we were talking, Plato's Republic, the work of the philosopher sovereigns isn't just to sovereign, to rule themselves, but to enable, the entirety of Calliopolis, his allegorical city, to become fully, I hate to use the term because it's sort of cliche, fully actualized beings, to fully recognize their own divine self. And according to Iamblichus, true happiness for the philosopher sovereigns or whomever we're talking about cannot be achieved until the happiness of everyone else can also be achieved. So it is this sort of intimately communal sort of mystical tradition, which builds outwards from I take care of myself to I take care of the people around me to as a fully purified soul, I engage in the work of the demiurge to help perfect creation itself, which of course has the effect of making everything within it better.
Okay. There's one thing you said right at the beginning there that I sort of want to jump back to, because it's a key interest of mine in relation to Neoplatonism. The emphasis, there's a strange sort of emphasis, but it's a non-emphasis on the body in Neoplatonism, as in Plotinus, which is obviously what I'm sort of knee-deep in at the moment, so I'll use that as a reference. Plotinus hated the body, it seemed, or hated his own body. The flesh was just almost like an afterthought of everything. Basically, that was the last thing one should even deal with. And then from this is developed a form of asceticism. Now, does this, you then mentioned that with, was it Iamblichus or Ficino, that we've become far, far more material. Does that notion of asceticism and the relationship to the body change throughout time? Does it sort of, do we develop it in such a way as when, once we have become, once we have sort of forgotten the soul in that way, do we then develop a different relationship with the body?
Yes. But not necessarily in the way that we might expect. We don't go Plotinus's route. Iamblichus's theology and theurgy, I think, are deeply embodied practices. You know, Platonism has this sort of love-hate relationship with the body. You know, on the one hand, you have like the Timaeus and creation is awesome and this is all good and stuff like that. On the other hand, we've crashed into physicality and all of our senses are weakened and we're just sort of trapped. And, you know, I don't know that Plato fully resolves this tension. Plotinus very clearly goes towards the matter is bad sort of thing. And for Plotinus, at least my understanding of Plotinus is not my area of study by any means. The ultimate goal is to escape incarnation permanently. And to exist in the sort of internal contemplation of the good or the one. That is very much not the case for Iamblichus. For him, even once you have a purified soul, which means that your soul completely recognizes that it is not the body, that it can the body is the sort of external thing that the soul has command over, much like the gods have command over their bodies, the planets, but the gods are most definitely not the planets themselves. Even once that happens, the purified soul still comes into incarnation. It does so in a very different manner, though. It does so in a way where what happens to the body no longer affects what happens to the soul, so that the soul can do its job in an embodied way, but without falling back into error, without falling back into forgetfulness, which is what most of us who are not fully purified souls, I know, speak for yourself, but most of us, we may have like the intellectual concept that we're the soul, but for the most part, our understanding is that we are our bodies. Whereas the theurgic sage, as I tend to call them, understand that they are not their bodies. They are their souls, and their body is something that they have control over to varying degrees. But the body has no control over the soul. So we've moved in a way where clearly the body is, I think, still inferior to the soul. But it is not something that gets discarded. And there's even sort of this kind of discussion, you see it to whatever has survived in Iamblichus and to varying degrees in Proclus, and even in Porphyry, about the nature of the vehicle of the soul and how many of them have. And this is sort of the interface between the soul itself and the creation, the universes, the various cosmosi, whatever the plural of cosmos might be. It's sort of the interface between the soul and everything else, including the body. And there's the sort of question as to whether do we have one that has both the rational and irrational soul? Does the rational and irrational soul have their own vehicles? If so, after death, what happens to these vehicles? Are they destroyed or are they kept? And you know, there's a bunch of different answers. You know, some were like, no, that the vehicle of the soul is temporarily discarded upon death, but it is not destroyed, so that when the soul reincarnates, it uses the vehicle that it already knows to do so. Versus others who say, well, no, the vehicle of the soul and to a certain extent the irrational soul undergo this sort of fiery purification, which destroys the vehicle but obviously doesn't destroy the soul, because the soul is not destroyable, just because the vehicle itself is so impure it cannot sort of survive the purification. And some even say, you know, this is sort of like the Platonic equivalent of hell, where there's this intense purification period. Which interesting, you find something actually quite similar in some forms of Judaism, where there is this notion of hell, but you're like only there for a year where you become purified, and then your soul moves on to whatever happens to be next, which might be incarnation again, depending on what type of mystical form of Judaism we're looking at, moving into Sheol or the afterlife. And for certain kind of people, people commit certain kinds of sins. Their soul sort of undergoes this purification for a year and then are completely obliterated, which is its own fascinating concept. But I digress, as I tend to do. I'm sorry. But I guess to answer your question, if I'm too late for that or not, the body is still definitely important in later Neoplatonism, in its own sort of particular subordinate way to the soul.
Okay, so from that it seems that we throughout Platonism, the means are kept. You always have the one. You have soul, virtue, evil, good, the body. These things are all communicating with one another in a certain way. What changes is the importance of certain relations between these as a means to always go towards that aim of becoming, as close, as divine as possible. That always seems to be the aim. Would I be somewhat correct in saying that the aim stays the same, but throughout these different contexts, the means to get there sort of change?
Yes, I would absolutely agree with that.
Okay. That makes sense. That sort of cleared that up. I mean, okay. I'll ask this question. I'm always interested to hear the answer to, as this is a podcast dealing with what I see as overlooked things, but obviously I have my own biases. Sometimes I've said, "Oh, this is overlooked or ignored in the academy," and then people will say, "Well, actually, no, it isn't. If you look here, here, and here." But I'm always interested to see if people actually think this or not. So, I guess, do you think that Neoplatonism is overlooked in terms of philosophical and historical study? And if so, why do you think it might be?
I think it was until, again, recently-ish, 20, 30 years. And again, I think the idea largely, I blame, I'll put a lot of blame on E.R. Dodds with this, and his manifesto of the irrational. It just sort of stuck. And as academics, we don't want to be associated with the study of something that's irrational, especially in philosophy. Though I don't think that's actually, there's any really good reason for that, because irrational things clearly exist and therefore I think should be studied. But I think in the last couple of decades, and really in the last 15, 20 years, we've seen a lot more study of the subject. A lot of that's thanks to Dr. Gregory Shaw. Some of that's Dominic O'Mara, who's a more recent-ish writing. There are sort of this handful of scholars that you can sort of count on two hands, who have decided to take the study of theurgy and religious Platonism as seriously as the study of the philosophical aspects of Neoplatonism. And for whatever reason, they've managed to get enough traction that it is beginning to replace Dodds's critique. I think it's Dr. Shaw who writes about this, where we're not studying something that's irrational. We're studying something that is super rational. It is beyond reason, which, the gods, the one, are exactly that. They're not something that you can grasp intellectually. there's something that you have to grasp experientially, so far as possible, as Plato would say. But they've managed, and I'm eternally thankful for this, because my book wouldn't exist without this. They've managed to, I'm not sure what the word I'm looking for is. They've managed to legitimize the study of this otherwise irrational seeming thing. And that has sort of changed everything in the study of later Platonism, I think.
Okay. So, I mean, one interesting question is where could we find this lineage today? Has Neoplatonism sort of extended? Are there people who are drawing from Neoplatonism, do they just call themselves Neoplatonists, or are there certain movements who are saying, well, we're influenced by it, but we're not, you know, directly involved, we don't consider ourselves Neoplatonists, you know, where could we find it today?
Yeah, I think the sort of biggest and most obvious area, though they will never admit this, is Eastern Orthodox Christianity, which is hugely influenced by the Platonists and Neoplatonists on almost every level. About almost everything that they do, you can see some element of Platonism in it. Now, if you talk to an Orthodox theologian, they will probably deny that for theological reasons. If we're talking, you know, outside of that, I don't know. You know, I've worked to some degree to try to develop, you know, a sort of modern Neoplatonic religion, to not a huge amount of success due to various reasons, but partially just the obscurity of the tradition itself. I mean, Platonism isn't quite as sexy as Gnosticism, you know. But for the most part, I don't think you see a whole lot of people calling themselves Neoplatonists. There are clearly things that are influenced by it. The modern ceremonial magic, which likes to call itself Hermetic, is usually more influenced by Neoplatonic metaphysics than Hermetic metaphysics, though they're related systems. Ficino, who people until very recently, you know, said was the arch Hermeticist, is very clearly a Neoplatonist who kind of uses Hermetic language because it's cool sounding, and it's not, doesn't sound like boring philosophy. I think we see it in varying degrees in modern Wicca and other modern paganisms. To varying degrees, we even see it in some of the Reconstructionist paganisms like Asatru, though I always thought that's a little weird because they're very different ways of thinking. We clearly see it in, you know, schools taking after St. Augustine, who was himself for a time a Neoplatonist, a practicing Neoplatonist before he converted. I think there are a lot of schools of thought that are deeply influenced by Platonic or Neoplatonic thought. I don't think any of them necessarily say we're Neoplatonists. And I think we would be hard pressed to find some sort of like direct lineage, you know, from Plato through Plotinus and Porphyry and Iamblichus and et cetera, to some sort of modern group, you know, like some sort of apostolic succession. I don't think that exists. And I don't think it's necessary, because that's not the basis of the oomph, the power, the mojo, whatever, in Platonism. You know, it isn't that direct, you know, like in Christianity, apostolic succession back to Christ, on a theological level at least, matters. I don't think that matters in Platonic tradition. I don't think we need to be the student of a student of a student of a student of a student all the way back to Plato and Socrates. I think that because it is what it is, this sort of philosophical practice, the practice and the philosophy are more important than it happened to come from Plato. The entire practice could come from Frank Smith and we wouldn't care, because the practice is what makes sense, the philosophy what makes sense, and that's what we put into practice. I think that answers your question.
Okay. Is there anything you would like to add about your book that we've obviously there was a lot more that we could add in, but is there anything you'd like to add which you feel is key?
Yeah, I as much as there's a deep intellectual side of the book, which is very much on purpose. If you read the book and don't in some way engage with the practices, and you don't need to do these practices. These practices are things that I created based on older things. They're modern versions of older things, but they're absolutely modern versions. They're absolutely things that I created, because we don't have any surviving Neoplatonic practices. So you don't have to do, my version of it by any means. But if you don't do some sort of practice, I think the book is kind of useless to you. It's a kind of interesting history, I guess. But if you want a history of Neoplatonism, there are better places to go. There are books dedicated to that. If you're looking for purely the intellectual, philosophical side of Platonism, go read the dialogues. The book is meant to be put into practice. Whether that means you just engage in the contemplations on the virtues and good and evil and things like that, or whether you engage in some of the theurgic practices, like the ensouling statues or paintings, or whether you move all the way through to invoking your guardian daemon. If you're not doing something practical with it, I don't want to say don't buy the book, because you should absolutely buy the book and you should buy it new. But I think you're missing most of what's going on in the book without engaging in that practice. To the extent that I have written another book that is going to be published soon, which is a book of hours, or modeled on Plethon. He did this sort of calendar reform in his new sort of paganism, and he created this sort of system of prayer. And I have taken some of that and developed it into this sort of system that follows the cycles of the moon and sort of cycles, monthly cycles, and these sort of seasonal cycles. And I've written a couple hundred prayers and hymns that you can, you basically have a set of prayers morning, afternoon, and evening, every day, basically forever, if that's something that you want to add to your practice. And I think that's something that we might have seen, probably not exactly in this way, because again, I'm borrowing from Plethon, so we're talking in the Renaissance. But I think it's in line with the ideology that later Platonism absolutely has a religious element to it, that communing with the divine, however it is that you want to understand the divine, is an important part of it, which is in living theurgy to some degree, but that's not the absolute focus of it. So I've got a Theurgist Book of Hours coming out from Avalonia again, a sort of a a kind of spiritual sequel, because I think that practice part of Platonism is so important, that more needed to be done about it. So I did something about it.
Okay, when will that be out?
Is soon-ish. It's on the website and coming soon, but it's not yet up for pre-order so far as I know. So I'm hoping in the next couple of months. I will certainly, on Facebook, I've got, pages for Living Theurgy and whatnot through Avalonia. So I will absolutely be spamming all of my Facebook pages when I know it's going to be coming out. But I don't have a exact date at this point.
Okay. Whereabouts can we find Living Theurgy? Where would be the best place to buy that if we're interested?
You can get it directly from Amazon or from Avalonia. Avalonia? Avalonia? I have no idea how that's pronounced, actually. Avalonia Books. And you just like do a Google for avaloniabooks.com. Otherwise, it's certainly on Amazon and sort of online retailers like that.
Cool. Is there anything you'd sort of like to add before we finish
I mean, there are so many things
up?
that one could talk about. I purposely try to cover a large amount of topics in a relatively reasonable amount of space in Living Theurgy. So I don't really know where to be. And all that sounds like this is that would be another lecture. So I think I'm good for the moment.
Okay. Seems like a good place to finish up then. But I'd love to talk to you when about your latest book when that comes out.
Absolutely.
But yeah, Jeffrey S. Kupperman, thanks very much for coming on.
No, thank you for having me.